Members, we're going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order.
Doug.
You will find your minutes in your packet. Representative Howe has a small change to the minutes. Representative Howe.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to change it from, we need to change the governor's proposal budget for the fiscal year from 2015-16 to 2016-17.
Okay. So members, if you look at the bottom of the minutes, with the paragraph starting with Cynthia Bowerly, Commissioner, at the end of that, the fiscal year should be fiscal year 2016-2017. All those in favor of that change, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Now we have before us the minutes as amended. All those in favor of the minutes for February 4th, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes for February 4th, 2015 are approved. Members, in your packet, we're going to be continuing the presentations on the governor's budget. We are going to start with the Department of Administration. And we have assistant, we've got Matt Scheer, et al. If you guys want to come to the table.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Matt Scheer, Legislative Director for the Department of Administration, and the Commissioner and a couple of our folks are still underway, but I guess I can get started with our budget presentation. And this morning we'll be starting to work off of a PowerPoint, which is in your packets. It's a copy of just a number of slides kind of generally detailing our budget. But generally, the Department of Administration, we've been around for quite a while. We were created by Governor Harold Stassen, and our mission is to provide the best value in government administrative services. And we do this by emphasizing a couple of items. First, customer satisfaction by serving our clients in a professional and ethical manner and producing valuable results. Second,
Mr. Scheer, I know you guys reviewed this the last time that you were here. So I think it might be more helpful if we can just kind of go over the numbers and the change items, realizing that you have a couple more people coming, but I'm guessing members will have some questions anyway.
Okay.
So I think what might be helpful is, good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning, Commissioner.
If we can go over the change items first. But before we get to that, though, too, we do have important business. Because we weren't able to get you guys yesterday, I did have some treats there that you're more than welcome to enjoy. You can take them back to your office, or you can share them here. It might benefit you if we're all consumed with eating, but might help your day here at least. But please enjoy those at your leisure. But with that, if you guys want to continue with your change items, I think that would be helpful.
Well, Madam Chair and members, good morning. Matt Mossman, Commissioner of Administration. I definitely feel like I'm literally between your breakfast and your eating and my testimony right now. So anything we could do to help pass the treats around and share them with everybody would be
awesome.
Fantastic. Thank you for thinking of us. I will probably not try to stuff one in my mouth and talk at the same time, although depending upon what questions I get later in the hearing, I may just have to bite into a donut. So thank you for your time this morning. I appreciate the opportunity to present the governor's recommendations to the committee this morning. You have a number of items in your handout. We have a PowerPoint that the department put together along with the MMB documents outlining the budget recommendations. And so, as you indicated, Madam Chair, the first few slides, I'll just skip over our background information on the department and its organization and its budget structure. I do want to just kind of, at the outset, kind of give just a couple of quick comments on the overarching kind of theme or driver context for our bigger budget recommendations. The Minnesota economy, of course, is doing well by most comparative standards with other states. We have a low unemployment rate, but certainly we have significant disparities that can be 2 to 3 times greater in some other communities within our state than they are for the general population, and part of our proposal really is to take a step back and look at where Minnesota has been a leader in incentive programs for targeted group communities, for Greater Minnesota, for economically disadvantaged areas, and certainly for our veterans who have served our country and are coming back looking for work, starting up companies, and wanting to make sure that there's good access to the state procurement process. So with that, Madam Chair and members, our first budget recommendation, and I believe that the slides are in an order where we can follow along both with the change item pages as well as Madam Chair and members, the first recommendation of the governor's is consistent with what you're probably seeing from a number of other agencies, which is a 1.8% across the board increase for the department's general fund appropriations for continuing core services and operations for those activities that we have funded by the general fund. That is an amount of about $396,000 for the biennium. With that, Madam Chair and members, I'll turn to, and this is where I'll probably spend the most amount of time on our the next proposal. It is certainly our most significant proposal that we have before you this session. The governor recommends a total of $1.233 million for the biennium and some FTE to go along with that, of which about $210,000 is one-time IT ask for a collection of equity and public contracting programs. Madam Chair and members, you're familiar certainly with concerns that have been brought before the committee in the past and the need for us to just better serve veterans groups and veterans businesses across the state in terms of preference programs, and to move forward with a state-based preference program. Part of this proposal is to seek the resources that were have been discussed in past sessions as well with regard to establishing a state-based preference program. Right now, Minnesota recognizes, the Department of Administration recognizes federal veterans preference for businesses that have a federal veterans preference. We reciprocate and just accept that. But the federal process is certainly very cumbersome and more cumbersome than we would like to see our veterans being served by. And part of this proposal is to move forward with the rulemaking and the outreach and the creation of a state-based certification process for state veterans business, veteran-owned businesses, to make sure that they have access to the state's preference programs moving forward. Along with that, Madam Chair and members, we would also would like to pursue streamlining the state certification programs for minority women and targeted group businesses that are in current law. So similarly, there are, for those who might not be familiar, there are three, if you're a Minnesota woman-owned business and you would like to become certified for the state's procurement preference programs, there's the possibility that you might be interested in three different certifications. There's a federal certification, there's a state certification, and there are some local certifications available as well. The federal certification primarily serves, it's administered by the state or the U.S. Department of Transportation. It's used heavily by about 20% certainly of companies that also pursue or are eligible to pursue state procurement preference programs. But the criteria are somewhat different, even though the goal is the same. What we're proposing to do is to streamline those programs so that the criteria for the state and federal preference programs are the same, but we would not follow the more cumbersome aspects of the federal process. And we think that that would do a number of really helpful things for state-based small businesses. One, it would no longer require you to have to be familiar with two sets of criteria. So the goal ultimately is to be able to identify and certify more businesses and to do so more simply for them. So about 20% of businesses, we believe, would no longer really have to submit pursuit to certifications because they're already being certified at the federal level for that preference program, and by aligning the criteria, we would just accept that criteria or that federal certification. Then also, and I think the neater aspect of simplifying and aligning the criteria is that we would do some IT work on the front end so that any business in Minnesota that is wanting to pursue either state or federal preference programs would be able to come to a single web portal that's branded, managed the same way, so that we steer small companies in Minnesota that are looking for that program in one direction.
And Commissioner, you would mention that sometimes there's a local component. Are you going to try and work with those local entities that have something to try and get them to be part of that as well? Or,
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the question. That's very important because they are really key stakeholders. We have been in communication with them all throughout the process and will continue to do so. Right now, there are many reciprocal arrangements with once a business becomes certified at the state level that it's typically accepted at the local level, and we would hope to keep that. What often happens at the local level, and we want to assist local communities who want to do this to continue to be able to have their own sort of self-determination around. Some of them have preference programs that just are just a size and no other criteria. So it's just a small business preference program, and so they would, you know, be able to retain that, and we'd be supportive of them having that system. So I think that it would allow it the whole system to work more coherently. And then in addition, members, this goes back to both for the veterans programs, for really for small businesses generally, but certainly for small veteran-owned businesses, for small businesses owned by disabled individuals, women and minority-owned businesses, and also businesses located in economically disadvantaged areas of the state that are eligible for these programs. One of the things that I feel like we have heard most clearly is that the certification is really only the first step of the process, and that what is really would be helpful to firms, both targeted group areas as well as around the state, is to be able to do more outreach and more work with them on just on this understanding the state procurement process, how the state makes what capacities are needed in order to secure a state procurement contract. So we're really looking at the outreach being an important part of doing this. The certification is really only the first step in the process. That, I think, is an important kind of just stepping off point for me to note that in the end of the day, when we do administer the solicitation process, it's important that the solicitation process, once it starts, be objective, fair, everyone participates in it. It is, and it's not, at that point, it's kind of, you have to, you know, it is what you bid, and that's what we have to base our criteria and selection on, so that we're making sure that we always are getting a good price, the best value for the state. But there's a lot of a front end, I think, work that can be helpful, and I think over the long run actually help a competitive foundation for making sure that more businesses and more small businesses are able to submit meaningful bids to through the state solicitation process. And so that is the essence of that proposal, Madam Chair and members. We would also, I think, be looking at working with other state agencies to just make sure we've identified all of those areas. Right now, the preference programs broadly apply to state procurement, but there are some situations. For example, the bonding bill is I think, the most common example, where a lot of times some substantial state resources are provided for, but they're granted out to other entities, to non-state entities, to actually do the work, and we would be looking at whether or not the preference programs should also apply in those situations where the state grants its money out to other entities to do major projects. So, Madam Chair and members, the next proposal is...
Madam Chair, over here.
Yeah.
Representative Detmer.
Regarding, I do have a question, Madam Chair, regarding this issue on preferences.
Okay. Are you okay with us just kind of getting through all the change items and then coming
That's
back?
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Because I know I've got a couple other people, too. Commissioner? Okay. I'm trying to make sure that we don't go over today. I can't bring in treats every time. So, Commissioner, if you could.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the department's the governor's next recommendation is for some additional resources for the SMART program. The SMART program is the Small Agency Resource Team. This is an effort that was started a number of years ago. I believe it was during Governor Plenty's term, and the program has grown and taken on some additional customers. As it's built up over time, and it's frankly become a fairly sought-after program among small agency boards and commissions. This is a program whereby the Department of Administration provides transactional human resource and financial management support, so you're accounting and procurement functions to small agency boards and commissions so that those entities can, I think, really two things, focus more clearly on their missions and statutory responsibilities, and also, secondarily, I think, just the efficiency and the effectiveness of making sure that those functions, those backroom functions, are done accurately, done consistently, and done in a way that's efficient for state government. And so what this proposal would be to, right now the program serves 15 agencies, and this program, this recommendation here would be to provide some additional resources for the department to be able to take on additional small agency boards and commissions into the program for those services. Madam Chair and members, the next recommendation is for $800,000 over the biennium for a required periodic disparity study. This is also related to the state's targeted group preference programs. It is really kind of here this biennium in this request as a matter of timing. About every 5 years or so, the department renews this study as it is really kind of required legally in order to provide the basis and the platform for and understanding the constitutional justification for the targeted group programs for race-based and gender-based preference programs. So this is an ask to renew that study that was last initiated in 2008 and I believe completed in 2010. And then, Madam Chair and members, the Governor's last recommendation for the Department of Administration is $288,000, $144,000 a year ongoing, related to the Olmstead Implementation Plan. You all may be familiar with this proposal broadly. There are a number of recommendations in other... most of the recommendations around this package are showing up in the Human Services Committee and in other agencies. This relates to the state's efforts to implement its Olmstead plan for making sure that the state is doing all that it needs to do to provide for the full integration of people with disabilities into communities. And this ask here relates to a little bit of background. The department hosts, I should say, the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, which is almost exclusively federally funded and hosted at the Department of Administration, as it is required by the federal government to be hosted by a neutral agency, so an agency that is not also responsible for providing direct services to the communities being served. And so, but it is a key stakeholder and connection that state government has to the developmental disability community, and this small ask here relates directly to the implementation of the Olmsted Plan, given helping to give and make sure that the voice of that constituency is bridged and linked into the conversation and the work that goes on to actually deliver and approve the services that state agencies provide to this community. And those are the recommendations, Madam Chair and members. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have Representative Howe and then Representative Detmer. So, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I guess I want to go back to the ask for the folks in the Veteran Services and the small business, and I'm a big supporter of that program that we've been working on, and I see that currently in the in that limited support for the small businesses, it looks like you've got about less than 1,000 businesses in that process, and how many? And it looks like you've got less than one FTE handling that now. What's the process time for those applications today,
Commissioner? I think you're
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to get some help on the process time. Thank you for the question. But I thank you for the question, because this is actually really key, I think, to the overall proposal. That is correct. We have essentially less than one full-time FTE and then some, you know, managerial support above that that's not included. But essentially we have, that's our current FTE on the program. And what's meaningful about that is essentially then what we end up in is this situation where we're kind of just processing the certification process. And I think that the targeted group businesses and the program and the effort to be successful needs more support and work around that, both just around compliance, around data, around accountability, and oversight of the program, and also, as I talked earlier, around the outreach function. So we have the state requirement is 60 days, so we do meet that 60-day requirement, and hopefully we do them sooner than that. And that's, you know, one of the key things, I think, in understanding this is where the clock starts ticking on that. My understanding from what I've heard from folks who in my staff who's been part of the conversation for more years relative to the veterans' owned businesses is that a lot of times I think the federal government might actually cite a statistic that's better than that, but I think that it's our understanding that that there's a lot of slow and front-end work that happens before they actually officially get the application or consider themselves as having gotten the application, and then they start the clock ticking. So we'd hope that to be a beginning to end timeline.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the follow-up with that, and you are correct, is the federal program, it starts when the application is considered to be complete, and that is a very cumbersome program to get to that point. They're not very, it's kind of vague trying to navigate those waters, and so I appreciate that. But how many veteran applications have you anticipated to collect on this process? I mean, even with the outreach and everything else, what is your estimation and how many applications you're going to get through this process? And what's your involvement with the Department of Veterans Affairs as we meld this process together?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Howell, second part of your question first. We have been, the Department of Veterans Affairs will be a close will working relationship. We will have been in contact and in communications with them throughout the whole proposal going back to last legislative session and during the interim. They are a key. What we would want to make sure about and what we've been working on is keeping the preference programs kind of in order to have that central portal all in one place, but in particular working very closely with the Department of Veterans Affairs. They're very close to the veterans community, obviously, and to the constituency group. Just so in terms of outreach and marketing and making sure people know that the program is available and steering them towards it, it is, has been, and will continue to need to be a very close working relationship. When we completed the fiscal note last session that this was based on, there's, I believe, a 2007 survey of data that identified the likelihood that there's about 600 veteran-owned businesses in Minnesota, and you know theoretically there's more than that now. So that was the basis for the fiscal estimates that we have built in to this calculation. We would hope that most of them would become registered. We will. It's certainly something that we would know over time, but we want to make sure that we're positioned for success as we move forward with the program.
Representative Howell. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Howell, for bringing up many of the points that I was going to bring up, but I think it would be important for the committee to understand maybe the process, how you're going to be working with the Department of Veterans Affairs and how they're going to be maybe identifying a veterans-owned small business and certifying them as, yes, they are a veteran, and how that information is going to be maybe worked through your department. And this is something we've been working on for years, committee members. We had a bill last year that was signed into law, the policy part of the bill. We did have some funding in there for one FTE to manage the program. That was pulled out in the conference committee. So I am going forward with House File 141 now that will put funding for one FTE to manage that the program. So, Commissioner, if you could just explain how this is going to happen with the two departments.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Detmer, thank you for the question. And first of all, let me just take a moment to thank you and appreciate your all of your leadership over several sessions, as you indicate, on this issue. The department, I know we greatly appreciate and want to continue working with you and Representative Howell and all others as well on the issues. So what we have is... So when the Department of Administration does solicitations, obviously, and we maintain just a little bit to give a little bit of framework as to kind of how the program works, when we have certified would be veterans or minority targeted group businesses, we maintain not only trying to have a centralized system for bringing them in and achieving the certification, but then we maintain a central database. As I indicated earlier, we work with local governments. And the value of having that all in one place is also very beneficial to prime contractors and others or local governments who want to be able to come to a central place and identify if they just want to work off the state system. So that's one of the real values of having all of the programs, if you will, in terms of the final product in one place. So with veterans programs, though, in particular, you know, what among the things that we have been and working with the department on already and would continue to do so is, I mean, first of all, the key criteria for determining whether or not an entity is eligible is a fact-based piece of information as to whether or not an individual is a veteran that the Department of Veterans Affairs is well positioned to know. So just in terms of having kind of the basic check for information as to who is and is not a veteran, we would work with them on that, as well as you know, the Department of Veterans Affairs has a number of they just outreach with veterans groups in many different forums, as you know, and so I think that they are when we would go and do outreach on the part of the Department of Administration, we would essentially be conducting outreach efforts and training efforts and informational efforts for all small businesses in all likelihood, but then all targeted groups, so veterans, disabled businesses, women and minority-owned businesses, and all small businesses. And so as part of that, in order to, I think, from a marketing standpoint, the Department of Veterans Affairs as a partner would be much better positioned than us to connect with those communities, and that's a key area that we work with them on.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. One is outreach to the minority businesses. There's a number on the east side of St. Paul, I'm sure throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm just wondering, you note that it is a complicated process, certification process. What practically occurs for outreach to these groups, or what would it look like on the ground, the outreach to these targeted minority groups?
Commissioner?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, right now we actually do fairly little. We do work with, I can get the name for you, I don't remember the name off the top of my head, but we do work with a non-state nonprofit that does host a few events across the state, and so we oftentimes participate in those events. And so essentially what think of a community forum, if you will, whether it be in Duluth or in the metro area, where we would attract as many small businesses of all types there as we can, and provide information on how the state procurement process works, right down to kind of connecting them to where they go for information, how they come into the website, where they look for solicitations, and how they respond to them in a way that's consistent with the parameters that we have laid out for us as an agency by law and rule to follow that process. And so that would be, so it would, I mean, it's almost like an education or educational based community forum is one certainly avenue. And, you know, I think one of the keys is when we would want to sit down with veterans groups, with targeted group businesses, and do a better job, frankly, of just asking them and learning more about what would be helpful as we've been doing, and tailor that effort.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then as I look at these change level items here, would we anticipate any department bills that implement them, or how would we see these changes in actuality?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, yes, we will. There will be language that goes along with, in particular, with the change items, in particular with regard to the streamlining of the federal DVE program and the state certification business program for minority and women-owned businesses. Just to highlight, right now our criteria for the state-based preference programs are all in rule, laid out for the most part in rule, and in order, so we're going to have some language for you that would allow us to align those criteria with the federal DBE criteria. And so just to give a flavor for the committee as to what that what some aspects of that are, there are in both the state and the federal preference programs, there is periodically, the federal government computes it more frequently than we do perhaps, which is one of the departures, but there is a calculation by industry code that sets a size limit in terms of what defines small and not small for participation in the program. And so we have two sets of size standards right now by industry code, a federal threshold and a state threshold. At a very high level, both programs are trying to achieve the same thing, which is just to have a size limit that that distinguishes large from small and provide a mechanism for entities to register as small targeted group businesses so that they can participate in the preference program. So my, you know, our thought and is that that's just a, if you look at the overall goal of the program, having two sets of size standards is just not key to the philosophical effort of the program. And so we would align on those size standards. And what we've done is we've done some analysis of the 900 businesses that are already registered for the state preference program, and in about 87% of those industry codes, the federal size standard for those industry codes is actually a little bit higher, so we would not lose any Minnesota certified businesses. And then we did a case-by-case comparison of businesses in the other industry codes where the size limit, if we conform to the federal level, would actually go down a little bit, and all of those businesses, based on the information we currently have, would appear to continue to be eligible for the Minnesota Preference Program. So that is just, to me, a kind of additional justification and piece of information that is, like, in terms of having simplicity and streamlining the process, there's no great need to have the two sets. And so we would just accept the federal determination of what kind of defines large from small across industry codes, which would streamline the process and make it a lot easier for small businesses to understand and not have to know both sets. So there are other things like that, getting back to your question, and we will have legislation to help effectuate aligning those programs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last question.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Dealing with the SMART program, just so I understand it better, do the agencies that receive that service then pay fees for SMART services? And if they do, why wouldn't we just fully fund the agencies for those services rather than pay fees to SMART? Just trying to figure that out a little bit.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, and I can get you more of a breakdown if you would like later, have us get back to you. But these businesses or these agencies here that you see are essentially served by the general fund appropriations that we get, and we do not charge them. We do have a small group of entities that we also serve through a fee-based, and sometimes that's a short-term thing to help a small agency board or commission get over a hump. We have that opportunity, but the focus of the program fund from its outset and the general fund portion is for those agencies that are small enough to where to make a good case for a general fund support as opposed to a fee-based support.
And I'm just curious, Commissioner. I know in the 2013 session, you got an increase of about $185,000 per year and another two FTEs. How, what happened? Why was that not meeting the needs of the agencies that were requesting it with a 75% increase?
So, Madam Chair, I don't have the agencies that might have been added off the top of my head, but I can look into it and help identify. I assume we expanded service at that point in some way, but I can look into that and get back to you. I'm not sure how we allocated that in terms of what additional agencies or services we expanded to.
And I think it might be helpful, too, to kind of see what your fee schedule is and what that equates to. What are you getting? What's the bang for the buck for these agencies' cost per item that's being requested? I think that would be helpful. And I'm I'll pause on that because I know there's other members that have some questions, too. I've got Representative Albright.
Morning, Commissioner.
Morning.
I'm looking at your presentation, and I wholeheartedly endorse streamlining outreach and awareness or increase of participation in that regard. But I'm my first question goes to the question the point of we're wanting of targeting small businesses and preference groups. And I'm just wondering to the extent one. do they? Are we looking for people that have the knowledge, a business plan, or the financing to do the heavy lifting to get a business off the ground? And if so, that's all well and good. But I'm also wondering, why wouldn't they also look to such agencies as Deed and others for what I would construe as to be similarly focused efforts on behalf of raising up small businesses?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, thank you for the question. Actually, that's a really important distinction. So our work would be with established small businesses that are wanting to believe they have the capacity and wanting to pursue getting into the game, so to speak, of providing their services and seeking out the state's contracts as one of their clients and customers. So you are correct that this would not be an effort around developing and creating new businesses, which is what is more consistent with the work that Deed does in terms of economic development. And one of the synergies that there might be, which would, I think, be a matter of just making sure that there's good communication and helping entities connect the dots across state agencies, is that it may well be the case that in order to make sure the state, I mean, ultimately, again, we want to make good procurement decisions for the state of Minnesota when we actually decide who we're going to work with or select as a vendor. The state has to have its needs met and at a good value. And so as part of doing that over time, there may be entities that are established successful entities but don't have the capacity to maybe to produce at the level of assurance that the state needs, in which case there might be opportunities and synergies to help connect and businesses with Deed and help, you know, identify are there different things that you maybe need to do as a business to position yourself in that regard. But our effort would be more around helping make sure there's greater transparency for all potential vendors that would pursue state contracts around how the solicitation process works, how the procurement process works, what are the criteria, what are the needs and capacities the state's going to have. And so both from a process standpoint and from kind of a value judgment standpoint, providing good information about when we're judging solicitations, what's going to be important to us, and making sure that, because then that gives businesses that are established and have not been pursuing contracts but who may want to, a better understanding of how the process works.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may be confused, but on the handout, the one handout on the top in terms of the request, it notates full-time equivalents of 5 in fiscal year 2016 and 4 additional in fiscal 2017 and beyond. So my math is correct, that's 9. But then as I look at your PowerPoint presentation, I note some additional FTEs that you're requesting. And it's a two-part question. One, can any of these new full-time people be shared between the organizations? Because if we're looking to streamline and get the most momentum out of the programs and the emphasis that we're placing on these programs, can they be shared? But then also in terms of if we're trying to drive people to technology and use services on the web, which is fairly apparent in terms of every other industry, that's where they're generating information, that's where they're generating the flow of dialogue between agencies and other business partners. I'm just curious why in an age of streamlining and outreach per se, we're adding so many people.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, Thank you for the question. I can only say that I do genuinely appreciate and have an expectation that we at the Department of Administration always look for efficiencies to work at the best value for the state. That's a key part of our mission. On the four and the five and the four, just to be clear, this is actually, it's not nine, it's five that goes down to four. For this proposal, the recommendation is that it would be five in the first year, and then it would go down in recognition of the notion that particularly with the veterans programs, but with the new getting the new functionality up and running, that there would not be that once that that there's some one-time effort involved in that, and so once that tapers off, we would drop back an FTE, which is our assumption in this proposal. But to your point more broadly, I'll just jump to maybe the number that you're asking about. Across our proposals, the department has an ask of 11.5 FTE in the first year and 10.5 ongoing is what it adds up to. I do think that if you look at the department's FTE count over a period of time, and I know MMB shared some information yesterday that that we could draw on and would be happy to share with the committee, but that we compare over time, even with this ask that we have here, fairly favorable in terms of our FTE count for the agency over a period of time. So, you know, my expectation would be that we would certainly do as much as possible to automate the system, to your IT question. And that's why I think it's so important to try and get the certification programs in particular into a common format and a common entry point for businesses, both from the simplification for them, from the way they, I mean, I am a big believer in customer service and making sure that we are always turning the lens around, if you will, is the way I talk about it with folks in terms of what do businesses that are needing to and trying to engage with this program see when they look at state government. And right now they see three different programs in at least two different places in state government. And I want a web portal that where they see one entity where they come in and get really convenient, intuitive, web-based assistance. That said, the reality is that getting certified is an important step for a lot of businesses, and there is, it is not unheard of because we experience that there is an effort to try and claim, for example, 51% ownership is the criteria to be a company that is owned. So there are some ownership and criteria that need to be where an IT-based system can be a starting point for that conversation, but it needs some hand-to-hand work in order to make sure the efficacy of the program is maintained over time also, and I think that's where some of the human work comes in and needs to be part of the package as well.
Just to that point, since we're talking about the FTE portion, members, in your packet you have from the department their history line of their FTEs for their agency. And the question that I have on this piece is, where would the numbers for the minute consolidation, where would that be reflected? What quarter would you see a drop? How many of your employees were doing IT work and now are part of Minute?
Madam Chair, it's about 14 FTE, I believe, was the conversion for the department as part of the consolidation, and I do not recall exactly, but I'm guessing it's in that 2012 or 13 range. I can get the date exactly.
If you could get back to us on that, I think that would be helpful. I think that's a question I'm going to be asking all the agencies. It was kind of brought up here yesterday, so I think that would be helpful to know. So when you get a chance, if you can give us back that data, I think that would be helpful. Members, we have Representative Anderson, Lunan, and Schultz on the list. After that, what we're going to do is go on to the next segment so we can keep on schedule. So, Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of getting that feeling, that left out feeling this morning, because I'm not a targeted group. I've started three corporations in my life. Last one I just started equally with my wife, and I'm considering right now, when we get done at this meeting, calling my attorney and changing the corporate structure and putting her to at least 51% of the company. Mr. Commissioner, I'm looking at this this disparity study where you're requesting an additional $800,000 for the next biennium. And my question, actually I have a few that I'd like to get an answer to, is how many years has this study been going on? How much was allocated for the first study? And if you could tell the committee here, what was the outcome of the study that you have so far?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and members, I can be happy to ask if you are okay with it, Dorothy Lovejoy from the department, to come up and help with that question, because I'm happy to answer it. I believe the first study would go back to 1990 being the first study, and I'll defer to Ms. Lovejoy.
Ms. Lovejoy?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dorothy Lovejoy. I'm in the Department of Administration, and I manage the Targeted Group Program and have for a number of years. The first disparity study was actually conducted in 1989, and I do not recall for the life of me what the appropriation was at the time. There was also a legislative commission at that time, so the appropriation was split between the study and the commission, and we can get that detail for you. The second disparity study was completed in 1999, and again, I'm sorry, I don't remember the appropriation for that, but we'll be happy to get that information. The last disparity study was completed in January of 2010. I believe the appropriation was in 2007. That one I do remember. We requested $850,000 for that study. We were appropriated $500,000. Proposals came in, and the winning proposal was $931,000. We negotiated. Department has an extremely skilled negotiator on staff, and we negotiated obviously a lot of scope out of what was proposed, but we also negotiated a significant reduction in cost. So that study was completed for, I believe, $557,000.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just trying to make some sense of with all these numbers, with the studies and over all the years. I guess my ultimate question is, will this study ever cease?
Madam Chair and members, that I'll start, and Ms. Lovejoy wants to add, absolutely. You know, I think one of the, to both your questions, one that I hope so, is the short answer to your question. I mean, I genuinely hope so. That, I think, would be the goal, not only beyond the Department of Administration, but for disparities in our economy generally. What this study, just to kind of give a little bit of background as to what this study does and the importance of it, is in any given year, what we really have at the state is data on the amount of procurement we do and who we procure with. But what this study does is takes a look at the Minnesota economy. So it starts with an econometric market-based analysis. What is the participation of minority and women-owned businesses in the Minnesota economy, and compares that to state procurement and finds and looks for and sees if there's disparities. And there are. So I think ideally, the absolute hope and goal, if you will, of the program, if I were to set what is the goal would be to get a disparity study at some point that shows that there's not a disparity and we don't have justification for the program. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have, Commissioner, is when we
we're basically steering some business to certain groups, and it is my assumption that it is to help those businesses to develop. In other words, what we're doing is rather than what we're supposed to be doing is creating an environment where they can get better rather than simply just do better. And do you look at data that you know, you've got the preferred procurement list, and then you've got, I'm assuming there's a non-preferred list that we deal with also. Are any of those entities transferring over where they can come in on an even playing field and they're doing business? Do you have that information,
Commissioner?
So, and jump in at just a little bit of an overview in terms of how the preference programs work, because I think it's really, I appreciate the question, because it's really important, I think, to understand as well that there's different types of solicitations that the state does. There's low bid solicitations, there's best value solicitations. Again, ultimately, we're trying to make sure that overarching all of this, we make and continue to make good procurement decisions for the state. So the way the preference programs work is that it is a percent preference within those frameworks. So you still have to be, even for a low bid contract, you still have to be, you have to meet certain minimum qualifications. The state needs to know that it can have its needs met in terms of the product that we're doing a solicitation for. And so, and then a preference program applies. So whether it be a scoring preference or a price preference within that contract context. So I just want to be clear that in terms of the notion of steering procurement, it's a preference program. It does not mean that we're necessarily just making different or lowering our expectations or our quality or our needs for what the state is procuring in any way to steer contracts. But any detail, please add.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Lunan. Oh, Ms. Lovejoy, go ahead. Sorry.
And Representative, I think the question you were asking may be, do those businesses ever grow and get out of the program? And we have some very extremely good success stories. In fact, just this week, There was a company who came to us with a pickup truck and a dream back in their mid-80s, probably, and was in our program for several years as a construction contractor. This week, he was named one of the top 100 black-owned businesses in the country. That's a success story that I'm proud to have been a part of. I was there in the early days when all this young man had was the dream to be a construction contractor. And it was very heartwarming to see that this week. We've had many success stories like that. So they do grow, do become productive, very productive businesses.
Yeah, Thor Construction, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Great article on it. So, Representative Lunan?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The preference program, it doesn't affect the expenditures that the state's making then. To facilitate these situations, I mean, I understand what they're trying to do, and I agree with helping people develop. I get that. I'm just wondering, it kind of goes back to Representative Anderson's comment that at what point is there a litmus test at which all of a sudden we take the training wheels off, and now they're on their own, they go. And with these, I'm a little unclear, I guess, that if we've got a special group, so that we have an uneven playing field that we're creating intentionally. What's the there's obviously a downside to that. We're either paying more or lesser quality. I mean, there's got to be a downside. Otherwise, it would just be an open competition. I'm not following. I apologize,
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Lunan, I don't know that it's necessarily. I don't necessarily agree that there's necessarily a downside. I think a key part of the program really is, I think that you could have, it's kind of human nature to work with to work with companies that have maybe won solicitations in the past, are best suited to know maybe what won them that solicitation and to know what the state's needs were and expectations. So I think that's true across our entire economy, across everyone that purchases products and services. And I think if you accumulate that context over many, many decades, what I think one of the key important things of the preference programs is to say, you know what, there are companies and companies with particular characteristics that have not historically been in that winning those awards. And so this is an effort to try and break down and adjust and modify that accumulated history in terms of who has been tended to get the state awarded contracts.
Representative.
Well, and I'm going to ask you to do my job for me. The when someone back in my district asks me why we're doing it this way, what's my elevator talk? What's my speech?
Commissioner.
So, Madam Chair and Representative, I would say that, you know, I think as a part of all of this, my hope would be that we would actually first of all, there are preference programs as well for companies from economically disadvantaged areas of the state, which I believe is 40 mm-hmm. counties across the state. So the program actually does have potential benefits for large parts of the state as well. And so you know, that might be part of your elevator speech, but I think also my hope would be that as we do more outreach and are able to provide better information, that it would just generally help all businesses.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I'm looking at the FTE trend chart that you provided, and I'm just wondering, it looks like you lost since 2009 around 50 or 75 FTEs, and I'm wondering, is that from positions that went unfilled because of budget constraints, or did you just have efficiencies in the department over time to get down to less than 450 FTEs?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative, it is in all likelihood a combination of all of those things. I think at the department over time there has been ebb and flow of various functions in and out of the agency to small degrees, both with the IT that was already cited a little bit maybe prior to this timeline or right at the front. We also used to be responsible for some building code issues that are now at Dolly. There certainly have been efficiencies, and we certainly also manage, of course, with the resources we have to take advantage of when we do have vacancies and transitions and things like that to make sure that we are staying within our budget and in meeting the needs of our mission. So,
thank you.
Okay. Representative Kahn, and while she is giving her question, if Mr.
Wilson, I actually pass. He answered it in that statement.
Awesome. All right. Thank you. We are now going to move. We've got Mr. Wozlowski here, who has been in charge of the Senate Office Building and the Capitol Restoration Projects. I've asked him to come back a little bit. Wanted to talk a little bit more about the financing end of it. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get MMB to come back because I know you all play a part in that, so we'll have to ask our questions of them at a later point. But Mr. Wozlowski, can you kind of walk us through on the financing part of it? I'm reading some of it about in the legislative, if members, just to help you track things, if you go to the legislature in your book, you'll be able to read a little bit about the certificates of participation. But Mr. Wozlowski, I was hoping that you could help us, or Commissioner, you could help us kind of walk us through how that financial process works. When will we start? How is that going to work with the Senate payments? What does the Senate currently pay in rent to you guys, or in lieu of rent to you? for the capital space that they have, and then how is the capital space accounted for in all of this as well, because they're not, they still have capital space, so how is that all configured into the overall amount? Or is that going to be a separate line then of renting that space as well? Mr. Wasilewski.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wasilewski, for the record. I'm the Senior Director for Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration. The financing mechanism, as Madam Chair pointed out, is certificates of participation. This is a common financing mechanism that's out in the market, both for local units of government and at the state level. We had a similar structure, although they weren't certificates of participation. They were revenue bonds at the time, but the structure was the same for the Anderson and Freeman buildings that were built in 2002-2003 timeline. Basically, how the process works is MMB is, as our financing conduit, similar as they handle geo bonds, they go out into the market and issue certificates of participation. To have that type of structure, there's documents that are put in place behind that, and one is a lease and purchase option agreement that is between the Department of Administration and Minnesota Management and Budget. If you think of that as more of like the mortgage type agreement that you'd have, it's related to the financing. And then underneath that is we have a sublease of the building to the Minnesota Senate, which is, again, that traditional model where Department of Administration's for all the buildings on the campus, we have lease arrangements except where in lieu of rent is involved. So again, using the Anderson Building and Freeman Building as the examples, we have a lease with the Department of Human Services, and we have leases with Department of Agriculture and Department of Health for the Freeman Building. So that's the basic structure of the deal, and you can think of that that lease arrangement, that sublease, is more of the facility management mechanism of you have a landlord that's responsible for providing facility management services, and you have a tenant that's utilizing the space. So that is the basic structure that's in place.
And Mr. Wasilewski, I mean, what would that lease look like? What does that all include? Can you give me greater detail on that?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, it's a standard form. We use the standard form that we use with other state agencies on the campus. It basically outlines the obligations that we have, the services that our plant management division primarily is going to provide as far as janitorial services, how utilities work, how we manage heating and cooling in the facilities. So there's basically, it's that facility management. What services does plant management provide, and what are they taking care of from an operations and maintenance standpoint? And then what's the obligations of the tenants in the building as well?
Okay. And Mr. Wasilewski, given the space allocation in the Capitol and in the new office building, how is that figured into the numbers that are here?
Madam Chair, the change item is solely related to the Senate building, and the Capitol building is still that in lieu of rent. So both for the House and Senate, as well as the ceremonial spaces in the Capitol, that'll still be through an in lieu of rent appropriation.
Okay, so that will stay in place, and now we'll have an additional payment from the Senate in lieu of rent. So there's going to be two in lieu of rent payments, essentially, is what we're looking at.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And that in lieu of rent also would apply to this building as well. So it's that same formula that hasn't changed.
Okay. I'm going to chew on that a little bit. I did have representative. She's crossed off. Any other members have any questions on this at all? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up to the chair's question in terms of the rent payment that was being provided just for a building in the Senate office building, if you could give me that number, and then what will be the increase now or in the eventuality that we will have two buildings to service the debt on, if that's correct, or what the rent payment will be for both the new Senate Legislative Office Building and what the rent payment is, if there is any, for the State Office Building.
Mr. Waslowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, make sure I understand the question. So the change in the rent is this change item that's here before you today is for the Senate building. That does not impact the rent for the State Office Building or the in lieu of rent that is being covered for the Capitol. And I don't have the amount for the Capitol with me or this building, but we can certainly provide that information.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'd just like a breakdown in terms of the cost for the space provided in the Senate the State Office Building, the Capitol, and the new Senate Legislative Office Building.
Mr. Waslowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we can certainly provide that and can do... some of those we have lease arrangements, so we could provide who's paying rent, for example, in the through a lease arrangement in the State Office Building versus in lieu of rent. So we can provide that full breakdown.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Waslowski, did you say that the rent payment for the Senate will stay the same then for the Capitol space, or will that be adjusted at all?
Madam Chair, members, the rent for the in lieu of rent, the total cost for the Capitol will be calculated again upon completion of capital restoration. Because we're changing the building systems, we have different mechanical systems, electrical systems, the space is different, so we do have to go back through and recalculate what the costs are going to be for the Capitol building.
And Mr. Waslowski, would you say that cost might be more, less?
Madam Chair, Commissioner.
Commissioner,
I would just, and on the technical side, Wayne could jump back in, but I think it's would helpful to just kind of underscore, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but in general, our methodology at the department for determining what is the in lieu of rent amount and what are the lease rates amount is the same. It's the same concept. It's the same general methodology of looking at debt service costs, building operating costs, et cetera. And what's different is that one is there are some, the Capitol, this building, there are some parts of the Capitol complex that are funded through an in lieu of rent payment and other parts that are funded through lease arrangements.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I would just add to that, you think about the utilities, the building systems are changing. We're increasing the number of restrooms in the building, so janitorial, there's just a host of changes after the rest of duration, and the building's going to obviously look a lot different than it did previously, and it's going to operate differently. So I can't see where those costs are going up or down, but they will be different because the building's going to be different.
And so, Mr. Waslowski, we didn't cover the debt service for the Capitol restoration in any legislation. I thought that was already covered.
Madam Chair, was handled that the debt service would not be, it's not going to be collected like it would be for on the other buildings on the campus. So there was specific legislation around the debt service for capital restoration. Basically, if you use the same formula that's used in other buildings in the Capitol, you'd be well over $100 a square foot on rent because of the significant investment that's required to restore the capital. So that debt service component is not being, there was legislation to not include that, have a chargeback related to that.
Okay. But I'm guessing given the new tech, the new systems, the HVAC, all that good stuff in the Capitol building, I'm expecting that we'll probably see an increase in lieu of rent for the Capitol space, whether it's the Senate or the House or the AG. Where would we see that in the whole budgeting process? Is that going to be kicked then to next year, or when will that take place? What's the timing on that?
So Madam Chair, members, we have the Capitol building. As you've heard, we have majority of the building reopening in January of 2017 timeline, so there will be still some time left in the biennium where the Capitol building is reoccupied. And so the in lieu of rent request that's been submitted would include that, our estimates for what that's going to look like for that that remainder of the biennium while the when the building gets occupied.
Okay, I'm not tracking. So the in lieu and rent will be part of this, or it's going to be part of a new request that you will have later on in 2017?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We'll have a better understanding of what those better estimates of what the costs are going to be for operating the building going forward after it's fully reoccupied and operational.
And Mr. Wasilewski, will the Senate continue to be paying their current in lieu of rent for the Capitol as they're kind of transitioning from the Capitol building to the Senate office building? So over that, it's kind of, isn't it like a year that we're talking about where they're going to be over in the new Senate office building? Will they continue to then pay what they are currently paying over in the Capitol, or how will that work?
So, Madam Chair, obviously there's been swing space components with the Capitol where we've moved tenants out of the Capitol. You're still paying both costs in the swing space locations as well as we're still heating the building and have occupied spaces. So it's covering both costs in the Capitol. And there's actually a separate appropriation that's involved called rent loss, because you have, in certain situations, you're paying both that swing space cost, but you're still having to cover utility costs in the Capitol building. So during this restoration period, there was a separate appropriation that helped cover rent loss in addition to the normal in lieu of rent appropriation.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have a question. If I heard you correctly, I thought you said that the rent will not change in the state office building, but I'm looking down the road, but also currently, you know, for example, on the lower level, which was at one time a restaurant, cafeteria, the sergeant's office is already taking over that space. It's already been remodeled, and they're functioning out of there, and I think some of the IT is already down there. But then eventually the Senate will be vacating basically the two floors or major parts of two floors that they already occupy here. So how is that rent being allocated in terms of the overall picture? I sat in on many of these meetings as an observer, as you well know, but I don't know that we talked much about the future of the state office building and the space that will be vacated and how that rent will be handled.
Mr. Wasilewski.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I should have been more concise in my statement on the state office building. So the rent is not changing due to the Senate building or the Capitol restoration project, but obviously as operating costs change overall on the campus, that impacts the building, and as the occupancy doesn't impact it as much, except if we're making restoration of this building or repairs to this building, that can have impacts to the rent. But obviously we made changes related to the swing space, but that was covered under that appropriation that basically there, where debt service was not being charged back, so that was not impacting the rates for the state office building. Clearly there's going to be some space changes needed. There's repairs needed to this building as well, significant mechanical, electrical, as you guys well know, the challenges with this building. So that's going to be an ongoing conversation, as well as, you know, what's the right use of the space that gets vacated.
Representative Carlson.
And Madam Chair, I'm not sure that everybody is aware, but there is somewhere in the pipeline, as you've alluded to, a major capital investment request relative to this building, because the HVAC and other issues are very out of date as well. So the picture is really more of the legislative part of the Capitol complex, including this building, as we move down the line. And I suspect what will ultimately happen with the space that the Senate occupies, you know, who will be the tenants there, because that's a fair amount of square footage. You know, if we observe the, and this is something I have commented on in some of those meetings, but if you observe this building and you go up and down some of the hallways, you know that things are pretty makeshift in a lot of places, because the needs of the building have changed since it was last remodeled in the 1980s. So how that space that the Senate is vacating will play into what the potential House needs are is going to be an important discussion at some point. I'm talking about, you know, if you look at the filing cabinets, temporary offices, you know, that have been put in the hallways and that kind of thing. Times have changed with the needs in this building, I guess, is what I'm saying as well. Thank you.
And members, for those of you that missed it, we had both Representative Carlson and Representative Kahn were on NPR yesterday talking about the history of the Capitol. I got to hear just the first snippet of it, but I didn't get to hear the rest of it, so I'm going to have to go back and listen to it online. It's kind of fascinating to hear your comments on it's the changes.
It's on the link, yes.
Yeah,
you can
great.
Get it and listen to it now.
Yeah. Just two more questions for me, Mr. Wasilowski. If you can get us the number, I'd be interested in actually knowing what the numbers are for the rent for this immediate Capitol complex. So the SOB, the Capitol, what the Senate is currently paying, what the House is currently paying, AG, governors, for that space in the Capitol. I think that would just be helpful. And then also, I've asked a couple times on the change orders. I wanted to check on the status on the change orders for both the Capitol and for the Senate office building and where you're at in getting those to us.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, members, just on the change order conversation, I wasn't part of that, but had heard about that, and I think it'd be helpful if I just described the delivery methods that are being used on the projects and how that is maybe different than members are thinking about it. So on the Capitol project, we're using a construction management at risk, CM at risk delivery method, and we're also having multiple work packages. It isn't like we completed 100% of the design and then bid out that design, and then we're tracking change orders where they're either unforeseen conditions or owner changes or things that were missing in the design. So it isn't like that where you, in this case, we have we're just finishing up that work package. Four was the completion of the full set of construction documents for the Capitol, but we've been working on construction through the other work packages for over a year and a half. So that it's different when you're talking about there's lots of supplemental agreements related to the Capitol, but that's has to do with the progression of that delivery method and how that design process works. On the Senate building, it's a design build delivery method. So again, we didn't go through a complete set of design documents, bid that out, and then tracking change orders off of that completed design. We were building as we were, the site preparation package was the first package that was done. And that work started while we were continuing to design the project. So it's, you know, tracking change orders is certainly a metric on projects, but you know, I would, from an industry standard, you would be tracking you know, how are you doing on your overall budget, how are you doing on the overall schedule, are you focused on life cycle costs, it's not the first cost that hurts you on construction projects. It's what's it going to cost to operate that building over 50, 60, 70 years. So are you making good decisions on the durability in operations and the maintenance of the system? So I think some, you know, maybe some conversation with staff to get more specific on what is being looked for regarding that. But just hopefully that's helpful to have additional context on the delivery methods that are being used on those projects. And it's also important to note that both with the Capitol and the Senate building, we actually wasn't just a CM at risk. We also did a design assist where we brought the mechanical and electrical major subcontractors, Minnesota companies, in during the design process. So you had the full team, you know, the key players of the project, both the design firm, the construction manager, electrical, mechanical, subcontractors at the table as we're doing the design. Now, I can certainly talk about surprises, things that we've encountered in the Capitol Restoration Project as we're doing a remodel of a 110-year-old building that were unforeseen conditions that have come up, and
that we've had to use contingency funds to deal with. But, you know, so that's why I think it'd be helpful to get some additional information on.
Sure. And Mr. Wasilewski, what I'm primarily looking for, and I think you're on the right track as to what I'm looking for specifically, is, you know, we all saw the plans for the Senate office building, for example.
Yep.
Those were published. The designers came back and said, okay, we're going to remove some of these items from the original plan. So obviously there was a plan out there. Even though you're taking it in work package segments, you still had an overall plan of this is what the building is going to look like in the end. I know you're not just guessing as to, okay, we're going to do this work package here first, and then we're going to figure it out from there. So obviously along the way, as people are looking at that first original plan that you had for the overall building, there have been changes that have been made to the overall structure, and that's specifically what I'm looking for.
I'm sure that's helpful. I'd just point out that the plans that went before Senate rules, that is at a schematic design level, so there is, you still have design development and construction documents to prepare, so you're at an early part of the design process. So an example would be the amount of space that you need for your mechanical systems. Well, you have a schematic of that, but as you get into design development and construction documents and specify specific systems, electrical closets change, mechanical changes, so there's a natural progression that happens as you go through the design process, but certainly understand better what you're looking for and
sure.
Can provide that.
Awesome. Great. Thank you. Members, any other questions? We got Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I was just going to piggyback on that, as you go through that, we know you've got an overall budget. We know you've got a contingency budget, you know, what those numbers are and how you allocate funds towards each construction or phase package. That would be good to have also, because each phase has got to have a number, a construction number, or a dollar price to it, and that would be good to know as we move forward. Also, so those would be good numbers to have.
Madam Chair, Representative Howell, that's a really important comment, because the construction market this last year, the bids, we were actively doing outreach to get subcontractors to bid on our projects. And this just isn't Capitol or the Senate building. This is at the Minneapolis Vets Home and the other campuses where we have construction projects. So the market, and you see that it hit us hard when we were bidding in 2014 on our projects across the board. And so we did, certainly on the Capitol is a good example, with the Preservation Commission, have to have the conversation as we significantly went into our contingency funds that we had set aside for the Capitol because of where bids came in at. So it's a good distinct comment.
In Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, just that Mr. Wasilewski's just commented on the Preservation Commission, just harkening back to when we talked about this last week also, the Preservation, reminder that the Preservation Commission, in terms of the kind of governance structure and how the restoration project was set up, the Preservation Commission that includes members from both the Senate and the House and the governor on it, was the entity that was created to help oversee and approve those work packages going forward. So, to a key point of making sure that there was both legislative and executive involvement and oversight as that process has been happening, that's been in place. So.
Okay. Thank you for coming today, and we'll follow up with as we go along on these issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Executive Director Hector Garcia is here. They have just one small change item, so I think that we'll be able to cover it here within the time that we have left. And at some point, members, I know some of you have talked to me about the legislative auditor's report on the different councils, and we will be covering that at some point. But for today's purposes, we are just covering your change item request that you have in the governor's budget. So, Mr. Garcia, if you can introduce yourself for the record.
Certainly, Madam Chair. I'm Hector Garcia, the Executive Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, one of four state agencies that play the role of being a bridge of communication and collaboration between our respective communities and state government primarily, but not exclusively, also federal, local government, the private sector, nonprofits, and the media. We do a lot, as you will observe, in the documents that are being handed to you right now. There are four documents that we brought along, heavy on the financial side. I apologize if we did duplicate some documents. One of the items, which I believe was taken to your offices quite a while ago, is the annual report that we submit to the legislature and to the governor. And it's the brightly colored Latino document. And then we have three other documents, one of which I believe you must have seen. It's the MMB's small agency profile that we submitted some time ago. That describes what our organization does and the fact that we're requesting $150,000 per year in addition to our current appropriation of $375,000. Then there are financials for fiscal years 16, 17, 18, and 19. And finally, my main presentation to this committee today. And the first and second pages are just a repeat of our statute and our duties, our nine duties. And I would ask you to go to page number three, if you will, please. On page number three, after number nine, I mention that Lincoln, President Lincoln, I believe in his second inaugural address, said that as our case is new, so we must think anew. I believe the reality that Minnesotans are living today has changed radically, mostly because of globalization and the demographic growth of the Latino population and other minorities, which have brought to the fore the significance of the disparities which I believe we're dedicated to address. I think addressing disparities, reducing them, and eventually eliminating them should be the main goal of our statute. Unfortunately, our statute does not mention disparities. I think it should. Back in 2010, I met with Jim Nobles, the auditor, and with several legislators, and I told them that I thought the statute needed a lot of corrections. And I'm gratified that last year, the OLA finally did a report on our programs and brought to light three items, mainly the lack of clarity in the statute, number two, limited resources to do a vast amount of work. In our particular case, there are about 300,000 Latinos in the state of Minnesota, from Duluth to Rochester, all over the state. We have four persons working at the office, including myself, one of them in Rochester for geographic strategic reasons, which I will be glad to explain to you. I mentioned the limited resources and the lack of connectivity to government. For example, so that I can illustrate my point, when I started back in 2009, I asked, what criteria do you use to select the persons that are appointed to our board? At the time, it was Governor Pawlenty's staff, and I was told, that's none of your business. I call that being totally disconnected from the system, and I'm gratified to say that fortunately that has improved dramatically, and Governor Dayton authorized us to meet with his commissioners and assistant commissioners, and I think we've made a great deal of progress. While performing the nine duties that have been assigned to us, I think it's pivotal to keep in mind that our goal is to reduce and eliminate the disparities. So I think in terms of planned obsolescence, I hope there will come a time when this council will disappear. For the time being, I think we've got a lot of work to do. In terms of the use of the money that we're requesting, in addition to what we have, as you will see in our budget, about 90% of our budget goes towards staff compensation and payment for our lease. And by the way, we're going to have to move at the end of June to a different location. In terms of the new staff that we would like to have, is we would like to have our legislative director who is working 30 hours a week to work full time. We would like, in addition to our liaison in Rochester, who is strategically very, very important, to have somebody else in Worthington, perhaps. And so we would use the money for that purpose. We have part-time research being done at the office, a two-day-per-week person. In terms of the non-budgetary measures, which I think are very, very important, we have drafted, with the help of the revisor's office, changes to our statute, including the addition of representatives from the different cabinet agencies and the governor's office, in order to provide that connectivity to government, which we have lacked in the past. And we have also, we're also requesting that the four legislators who are on our board, two representatives and two senators, be able to vote, because I think that will give them a sense of ownership, and hopefully they will participate more frequently in our meetings and advise our board on how to proceed. I would also like to bring to your attention at the bottom of that page and in the next page something that I believe is terribly important, and it's the dual strategy that we have been promoting for some time with the governor, with legislators, the private sector, and many others. It's a dual strategy that says the following. It is not either social services and economic vitality, it is both. We are conscious of the fact that there are members of our community who need direly social services, and the great and generous programs that Minnesota has provided for a very long time. But I think in light of the 40-year disparities, which has us pretty near the bottom in the whole country in terms of disparities across the board for all of the minority communities, I believe it speaks loudly to the fact that there's something that we're not doing. And I think that something that is not being done might be that we're not practicing the historical lesson in the United States that immigrants are the economic engine of the nation, in combination with democracy, democratic institutions, and constitutional law, and the great opportunities provided by this country. But it seems that now that has been forgotten, because the new flow of immigrants are non-Europeans. And I think that's a mistake, and we need to tap into the great energy, ambition to work, and youth of Latino immigrants and other immigrants and refugees. And I think that can be done through the new Americans office that we have been recommending to the governor and to the city of Minneapolis, with the help of Council of the Americas and Partnership for a New American Economy. And we have also recommended to the private sector, namely through the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the Rochester Chamber of Commerce, that a Latin America center be started. You might be aware of the existence for several decades of the China Center at the University of Minnesota, which generated great exchanges between China and Minnesota, to the point where today Minnesota has the most Chinese students and the most Chinese professors in the nation, and has led to a great many trade opportunities, investment opportunities. I believe the same needs to be done with Latin America. Why? Because there are many Minnesotans who ignore the fact that Mexico alone buys from the United States over twice as much in products and services as China does. It is a well-known fact that China is our second trading partner. What most people don't know is that it's because of what they sell to us, not because of what they buy from us. I think maybe we should focus more on the people who are buying from us.
Okay, Mr. Garcia, we do have a couple of questions. We've got about 5 minutes left of time. I've got Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Garcia. I just wanted to make mention that I do have a bill currently up in House Research to reform the three councils of color, for the Latinos and the Black Council and Asian Pacific, to focus more on the clarity in the statutes, as the OLA said, that the focus needs to be more narrow and not and that we created them as a legislative liaison for us to know the impact of our legislation on these communities and what they need to bring to us to do legislative work. I do not see them as an activist group that's left to the profit, nonprofits and for-profit community organizations. So I'm trying to refocus that back to the purpose we originally intended, which is to work with us on policy issues. And yes, the goal is to reduce disparities in that process so that at some point we would hopefully have no goal, no reason to have them. But we do have a lot of immigrants coming in all these areas and need to take heed into how we bring those into the process of government in this country here and now and welcome them. So, as I said, I will have a bill coming forth.
Okay. And Representative Kahn.
Yes, Madam Chairman, thank you. Two questions, and maybe staff can do this a little bit better. The issue of legislators as voting members of various commissions, boards, and so forth. Is there any place where legislators are, except specifically, I always recall they go on as non-voting members because of the separation of powers.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm not aware of any prohibition for legislators to vote on our board, but I do think that there is something that needs to be done in order to engage the four legislators into greater participation and involvement in the affairs of the council.
Representative Kahn.
And then the other issue you mentioned, increased outlook at increased trade with Latin America. Does that include Cuba?
Mr. Garcia.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I think given the recent decision to renew relations or improve relations with Cuba, I don't see why that could not be done. I think it's a good opportunity.
Representative
Madam Chairman, it's nice to have such good allies in this fight as Cargill. So, you know, I think that there are many people who have a long time, starting with, I think, Representative or Senator, I don't remember what she was, Sandy Pappas and I came back from Cuba and presented Governor Ventura with a box of Cuban cigars, which helped prompt his trip to Cuba. So, and I know Commissioner Hugesson was a big favor of increased trade with Cuba because of we're clearly the best source of many of the agricultural supplies that they need. So,
all right, members, any other questions at all? Okay, Mr. Garcia, any closing comments?
I'm very excited about this opportunity to present our case to you, and I hope you find it intriguing and that you'll give me an opportunity to meet with you individually to discuss how some of these ambitious ideas could be implemented. And actually, we've made a great deal of progress thus far in proposing them. I hope you will help us do that. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you. And members, just kind of give you a lay of the land for the rest of the week, we're not coming back on Friday, that's okay. But for next week, we'll have more of the presentations for the governor's budget, so watch for emails on what's going to be coming up next. And with that, members, we are adjourned.